that's wrong with me is I start out speaking to people very quietly, and then I just sort of get louder and louder. I think that's sort of true of my writing too, until at the end of the book I'm rather overbearing.
Oh, I don't think that's the case, but what happens, I believe, is that you develop more confidence as you go on.
I think so. Yes, and you just look
at it. You can often tell, when I read an awful lot, I can often tell, especially in a long work, that the author is either tentative or sometimes overly literary at the beginning. Self-conscious, in other words. But
yes.
As the writer continues on,
yes.
He loses that self-conscious flavor and just starts to tell the story. You can see this over and over again.
Yes, yes. I think I start out rather weak. I've always thought that in all my writing, really, except I think a small place. I think generally I start out weak, and then I sort of somewhere around page 10 I sort of find myself. But it's sort of hard to undo the beginning, because your confidence depends on that sort of faltering beginning. So if you have to go back and make the beginning as confident as the rest of it, then, at least in my case, I sort of feel the whole thing will become undone, because it sort of depends on beginning in an unsure way.
Maybe the best thing to do is to write the book and then take the ending and make that the beginning.
Oh, yes.
That's happened. That's what John Irving did with the Cider House Rules.
Oh.
With the ending became the beginning.
Yes. Well, that should be possible, really, because, I mean, a successful thing makes a circle. So the end and the beginning should rather be similar.
Technically, it can be done with flashbacks,
yes,
and things
exactly,
like that.
Yes, exactly, yes. I'm not that good.
What, you're not that good?
I'm not that good that I could do that sort of thing. But it's true, one should be able to.
I read somewhere in the biographical material that was sent to me that you adopted the name Jamaica Kincaid.
I guess so, though but at this point it doesn't feel like an adoption. It feels rather like me. I sort of became a person, or the person who's sitting in front of you at the time I did that. So I feel rather like that. I feel... the other name I used to be, the name my parents gave me, was sort of someone waiting to disappear.
That's interesting. You know, many people, however, use pseudonyms for their writing. That's not unusual, but apparently your impulse was different. You wanted to make a separation between you of the past and you of now.
Yes. It started out in my mind, I suppose, as a pseudonym, though it was a pseudonym not for writing, but just for a person. I mean, that was going to be the person. The person I was going to be was going to be called Jamaica Kincaid. I started to do it when I started to write, because I didn't think that my parents, the people I come from, the place I'm from, would understand my writing. I mean, not the writing itself, but the idea that I was writing, because generally people who come from the place that I come from, when they go to places like the United States or Canada or England, they sort of work in some kind of job, usually, you know, a nurse, a servant, whatever. But something in you're lucky to get into the professions, but basically you just sort of work, and you support your family, and you sort of there's really no question of you stepping into a world that would be not understandable to them, such as the world of a painter or writer. So anyway, when I started to do this, I had left home for quite a while. I'd been away from home almost 10 years, and I still hadn't made the fortune that people are supposed to make, or any money at all. I just sort of gadded about. So I decided I was going to write, and I didn't want them to know that it was me. If it didn't work out, if it was bad, I had no thought that it would succeed. I just knew I wanted to do it, and I wanted to do it in a kind of privacy. And so I changed my name. But that had larger implications, because I didn't just change it for writing. I really changed it. But that, I mean, for my whole life. But that says to me that when I think about it, that my writing and my life must be inseparable. So it would make sense that if I wrote under a certain name, I would also be that name.
Interestingly, though, you are not from Jamaica.
No, no. I wasn't quite sure what I was doing, you know. I mean, now here I am sitting across from you and speaking to you about this thing that I did rather, you know, without any self-consciousness at all. Well, that's not true. You must have some self-consciousness if you're going to change your name. But I really had no real idea about it. I knew that I should change it because of my family and so on. But, you know, I don't really know why I chose Jamaica and not Antigua.
I had a great name for you, but in the context of the reasons for your changing the name, you probably wouldn't. But I was going to suggest Antigua Anderson.
Well,
that's not bad.
Quite, not at all. It makes much sense. It makes as much sense as Jamaica Kincaid, I would think. Anyway, but the thing about it is that once I did it, and I told my friends, no one had any trouble with it. There are people who knew me as the name I used to be, and the minute I told them, they stopped calling me that and have never called me the name they knew me by again.
So most of your friends called you Jamaica?
Well, I'd say all of my friends, except people actually who knew me from home. I still refer to Antigua as home. People there, I think, still call me the name they knew me by.
Well, when I was in college, my best friend was a fellow student whose nickname was Doc.
Mm-hmm.
Doc Tuverson. But his real name, of course, is James.
Huh.
To this day, I could not call him James. Everybody calls him James today, but since I knew him as Doc, it's always been Doc.
Yes.
And I cannot think of him when I see him in my mind. It's Doc. It's never Jane. I just saw a little article about him. He's head of a cable company or something on the West Coast, and he had his photograph and everything. James D. Tuverson. No, that's Doc. Oh. It's not James D. Tuverson. So I know you're the people who you knew as a child will never change it.
Yes,
they'll never picture
yes.
you.
And I don't expect them to. That's actually rather nice.
It's interesting that how you have used elements of your childhood in your work, many of them, particularly At the Bottom of the River, which is your first book.
Yes.
You had a vivid, very vivid childhood, didn't you?
I suppose so.
That's with you. When I say vivid, I mean it's one that you have drawn on, that you use, that you think about.
Yes, and I don't know why. I mean, it wasn't unusual for a West Indian, a colonial person, a British colonial childhood. I had parents, they worked. I mean, my father's a carpenter. I don't know why it struck me so. And, you know, I do remember that I was considered lazy and a daydreamer, but now I can see that what I was doing was taking notes. But every
mental notes.
Yes, mm-hmm. I didn't know that. And they also used to be sometimes accused of having too good a memory. I would remember, I would sort of just, someone in a conversation would forget, my mother in particular, in a conversation would forget some tiny detail, and I would seem not to be listening to her, but once I noticed she forgot it, I would just sort of step in and remind her of what it was. And she'd forgotten, and it would just shock her, and sometimes she was pleased that I had such a good memory, and sometimes she wasn't. So I remember that was always true about me. I was always being accused of remembering too much and carrying around a great deal of information, and no one knew what purpose how well it would serve me, or what I would do with it. I mean, there must have been hundreds and thousands of people like me who remembered everything, and what good would it do someone like me for the sort of life I would lead? You don't really need to remember all of these domestic details and social details if you're going to be a nurse or an office worker. But I just sort of would remember things, and I cannot tell why it struck me so. But when I started to write, I knew instantly that the details of not only my life and my past, but everybody I knew and how we came to be the way we were, would always haunt me, and I'd always draw on it. I think I always will draw on this area of the world, you know, I mean, of which I remain attached, to which I should say I remain attached. I mean, I'm still an Antiguan citizen. I can't say my childhood was unusual. It was very typical, but I can't say why it struck me so.
Well, I have a theory maybe you could comment on. There are things that happened to me in the last year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. They're kind of jumbled in my mind. I can't really remember them. They're out of my mind. But I can remember vividly things that happened to me as a child. I remember the very first thing that happened to me, I think, and that was when I was sitting on a swing in Wichita, Kansas, probably at the age of a year or a year and a half, and my mother saying to me, "Donnie, let the cat die down," as the swing begins to stop. And I remember that so vividly.
Yes.
But last week I can't remember anything.
Yes.
So all of these the first things that happened to you, I think possibly are the most vivid things.
Yes. Well, that's true. I think what happened to me is that I was able, and I think I'm able to find in them the source of other things, things in the present and things before my childhood. And I think that that's perhaps the only difference between me and if there is a difference between me and the people I grew up with, that would be it. And I don't know how that came to be so, really. I not only remember these things, but I sort of, I'm sort of very interested in how they made me. And actually, sometimes when I go home, or if I have a talk with a friend, they'll say, "Oh, you reminded me of something I haven't thought of for years. You've just reminded me of something I haven't thought of for years." And of course, I have just been living with the thing they hadn't thought of for years. For all the years they hadn't thought of it, and it just sort of torments me. I mean, I sort of try to figure out, to square it away, how it is, you know, we all got to be the way we are, where it comes from. And so anyway, that sort of, I don't know why this is true of me.
Do you go back to Antigua?
Yes, in fact, I was going to go back tomorrow or Thursday, until all of this happened in the rest of the world, and then I thought, well, I don't know how things are going to turn out. We people seem to think it's going to go in such a way that we in this part of the world won't be affected by it. But I'm almost 42 years old, and I've lived in America for longer than I lived in Antigua, and I haven't really learned to think like an American, which is to be optimistic and to think things will work out just the way I want them to. And on the whole, they usually do for Americans.
Well, I'm an American, and I'm not particularly optimistic about what's happening.
Well, well, maybe you're first generation of American who isn't so optimistic. I've never seen anything like it. I was in the post office, and I was speaking to the postman, and he asked me about going home, in fact, and I said, well, I was going to go home on Wednesday or Thursday, but now I don't think I will because I didn't know if I'd see my children again. It seemed to me a likely possibility. I mean, who can tell? And he said, oh, don't worry about that. Go ahead. It'll never come this way. You know, and I think that you know, it's quite possible it won't, but I just don't know. So you asked me if I go home. I go home, and I was going to go again, and just sort of I actually wanted to go visit my mother's family and they're from Dominica, which is one of those islands that it rains so much they don't have a very big tourist industry. And so if the only reason to go there is if you are interested in tropical rainforests. It's very beautiful.
In tropical rain.
In tropical rain.
Well, when you go back home, and I guess I can call it home because...
Yes, it is. It's the place I call home. My husband's always very annoyed at me.
Well, are they aware of your growing reputation as a writer, and do they read your material? And what kind of reaction do they have?
I think they would have understood it better if I had been a cricketer, the world's greatest cricketer at the moment, and perhaps one of the greatest cricketers in the history of cricket, is a man from Antigua named Vivian Richards. And if I had done that, that would have been understood. Or if I had been Madonna or something, that would have been understood. I think that... it's perhaps a curiosity, but I don't know how. I don't think it's very much read. I think they
are your books distributed.
Yes,
at home?
Yes.
So you can go to a bookstore.
Yes, pretty much. Yes, if there are some left, or if they're usually, I suspect they might be in order.
They have a sign in the window saying "local author."
No, I don't. at least I've never seen it. But I don't think they really make much of it. I mean, I don't think it means much to them. There's a man who publishes a newspaper. His name is Tim Hector, and he's always, when Lucy was published, he wrote in his newspaper that something extraordinary had happened, and the ordinary Antiguan hadn't stopped to take note that this daughter of Antigua had published her fourth book. And that people hadn't, I don't know why they should, but he's someone who thinks that, this is something to be proud of or to be thrilled by. But I think the average Antiguan, certainly official Antigua, just would never pay attention to it. I mean, I think that ordinarily, you know, as far as I know, it's not a place that just produces writers by the dozen. So ordinarily, I sort of hesitate to say this because it makes me sound very, as if I want to be self-important. But anyway, I mean, and I'm sure I do, but I would rather not admit it on the radio. I think when I go home, for instance, it's not as if the Minister of Education, say, would arrange for me to visit the schools just for instance, certainly not have tea. There isn't any attention. There wouldn't be any attention paid in an official way to someone like me.
Is there a university on Antigua?
Not anymore. There used to be a teacher's training
So they have
college.
To go somewhere else,
yes,
to get the higher education.
Yes, Trinidad. They have something, they have those phony medical schools like the one in Grenada.
Yeah.
But they're not for Antiguans, they're for obviously Americans who can't go to a medical school here.
But they don't count anyway. They're not liberal arts. I mean, they have a very specific mission.
That's right. They don't have. They I think they think they have something called the University of the West Indies, but it's not a proper university. There used to be, actually, in the colonial era, Antigua had a very good educational system. It's not unlike things you read about parts of Africa that seemed, during the colonial era, to be suffering, and one always thought, and I still do hope, that the removal of Europe from these places, and they would just sort of grow in prosperity and actually, I hate to use this word just because it's in such disgrace, because people use it for such horrible reasons, but actually liberty. And in fact, the opposite's happened. And so that's very, in places like Antigua, especially in a place like Antigua, it's really much worse off. And I never, since independence, and I never dreamt that that would be possible. It didn't seem as if it could be possible.
But you've been away for a long time now. You have your family. You live in Bennington. Mm-hmm. You have your family here. You have your children, your husband. Your work is here.
Yes.
It's very unlikely that you'd ever go back, isn't it? True. I mean, now as
to live.
Permanently. Yes, to live.
I don't know how unlikely it is. I think the more I sort of find, I mean, obviously my husband, I think he wouldn't live there because it's hard enough to get him to live in Bennington. He's a real New Yorker and comes to New York as much as he can. He wouldn't live in also I don't think he'd live in a hot place, but I don't know. I can imagine living there. And the more I sort of find myself, strangely enough, I couldn't do there. I can only do it here. The more I understand how to live in a place like that. I don't say I could never live there. I
think it'd be very hard for you. You know, you run there, as you just said, there is no university.
Well, I'm 42 and life changes. Who knows? I'm 65. I may want to live there.
Well, but you also, who are you going to talk to? There are people who are of your artistic, creative temperament that in order to fulfill it will have to leave. And so you would be going where people like yourself have left.
Well, I have to tell you, I live in a small town in Vermont, North Bennington. It's quite different from Bennington. North Bennington is not a hotbed of intellectual
life. 10 minutes.
Well, what do I do when I come to New York? Well, I come and talk to you. But I can imagine living there. The more I find my way in the world, the more I can see that I would never give up a place like that. I consider it an enormous blessing and piece of good luck that I come from that place. You have what you have and you make the best of it, but that's quite a something to have, to come from a small island that has a tiny, tiny place that has an enormous history and very rich in things. I mean, these are the places that used to set off the sort of disaster that we are facing. You know, people used to go to war over these places.
They're still doing it. Look at Kuwait.
Yes, that's
about the same size
as
Antigua.
That's just what I mean. The sort of disaster we face today is what... you know, who would rule these little places used to inspire the same sort of nonsense. So it's very, you know, and for hundreds of years, these places in a way shaped the world.
They certainly,
that we know today.
And it certainly shaped you. I mean, it was more than just, we're talking more than just the memories of a childhood here in your work. We're talking about a very specific child, because everybody has a specific childhood, but yours is so lush in some respects. You describe Antigua and the way it appears, the colors merging and this sort of thing. But of course, that's the type of person you are. You probably would find these colors merging if you grew up on the plains of Kansas. You would see things like that. It's your way.
Well, I don't know. I have to say that the other thing that I can't leave out of my equation is my mother, who I have a typical West Indian childhood, in some ways it's not true. I had an unusual mother. I had, for instance, a mother who read books all the time. I mean, she read in a way that I had never seen anyone read until I left Antigua. And actually, the sort of person who would have read like that in Antigua would have been a European. She read for no real reason other than she loved it, and she just was very interested in lots of things. I, for instance, remember reading over her shoulder a book that was, each chapter was a biography of some great person in European arts or science, arts and science actually. And I remember it had a chapter on Mozart. I'd never heard of this Mozart, but I couldn't have been more than five or so. I just used to read it over her shoulder, and I didn't understand it. I don't remember anything from, for instance, that chapter, but I remember her reading about Louis Pasteur and explaining to me what he had done. And her illustration of that was boiling the milk, and why it was called pasteurization. So that was my mother. She also did, and certainly among the things that would have influenced my interest in words, this would have been it. When I was 7 years old, she gave me for my birthday a copy of the Oxford Concise English Dictionary, which I used to just read. From starting at A, I would just read and read this dictionary. I don't know too many. I was 7 years old. I remember exactly its blue, the blue of the cover. And I remember how worn the thread got from the cover, because I used to just use it so much, and that I would use the point of the book, the dictionary's cover, to clean dirt from my fingernails, you know, that sort of end of the a book. So that would have been an unusual thing. I mean, I think if I had a typical West Indian childhood, and in fact I did, the unusual thing was that I had an untypical mother. She was, and is actually, sort of rather dynamic and imperious. I still think she was sort of, you know, a queen or something that someone gave away, that she was, because she was very imperious, and she knew all sorts of things, and brought me up in this way that when I was a real child, and when I became a teenager and I began to actually express myself in this way that she had brought me up, it was very it was awful for her, because
you probably clashed.
We clashed a great deal, because she brought me up in a way that there was no place for. She brought me up to be sort of like a little English person, but there was no place for it. There was no way I could be a little English person in the first place. You know, I was going to be, in fact, a servant. And I had just sort of been brought up to have just sort of wonderful manners, and I was always dressed very well, and, you know, and encouraged to speak well, which was to say I couldn't speak broken English. And then suddenly I was just this sort of person with nothing really underneath. I mean, if anything made me not fit in, it was the way I was brought up. And she suddenly had this young woman on her hands who was just sort of crazy, sort of depressed and
rebellious, probably, to
a degree. Yes,
but adolescents are very typical.
Yes.
Well, here you have a problem. You have a rebellious adolescent with a creative streak such as yourself, and a mother who has a preordained expectation as to what her children should be like.
Yes.
And, I mean, this is not untypical, and so here you would no doubt have
yes.
this clash.
But also in the middle of it, midstream, so to speak, she changed. I mean, the circumstances of her life changed, so the girl I'd been brought up to be didn't really fit, so it was all very... It was quite awful.
Well, I assume that many of the stories that you have written are autobiographical in nature, and the mother, the mother in the stories, there does seem to be kind of a love-hate relationship there.
Yes, yes. Well, it's... I think it would be very difficult, and I sort of almost can see this is perhaps going to happen to me and my daughter. There's this... it's just almost impossible not to have that those kinds of feelings for someone as important as my mother was and is to me, and as everybody's mother is, but she really made an art of being a mother, so that I think most people, when they're being parents, they try to keep their personalities out of it. You know, they sort of are parents in one way, and they sort of go off and themselves. They sort of, I think, actually, I hear American people my age complain that I never really knew my parents because they only saw their parents in this way, and then they hear about them in another way. Well, my mother never did that. I got everything, and she had a lot of, you know, everything. So it was impossible for me not to feel, I knew her very well, know her very well, and it was impossible for me not to love her and love the things that are wonderful about her and also hate the things that are not so wonderful about her. I mean, she actually just sort of inspires very strong feelings in everyone and in me the strongest.
Have you reconciled your relationship with her now that you are... an adult, you go back to visit...
Oh, she comes to visit me. Yeah.
Or do you still clash?
We don't clash, but it's not because we can't. It's because we... I mean, I have grown up. There's no reason to do that. But I'll tell you, the last
time... She may have grown up, too.
Quite possible. But I'll just tell you something. The last time she came to visit me, she stayed for 3 weeks, and I had a wonderful time. I never looked better, everyone said. She left... I got sick for a month for every week she was here, and I thought it was really significant that one of the things that happened, I got chicken pox, which is a childhood disease, and a disease I had had already as a child. So is the conflict
there was
resolved?
Some stress. There was some stress. When my mother was alive, I could visit with my mother for maybe a week. Toward the end of the week, that was about it. After, because toward the end of the week, she began to evolve as a mother again.
Yes.
I wasn't just the perfect young man going back to visit after having a career in New York. That was the first day or two. But after a while, she would begin to treat me as I was an adolescent again.
Yes.
You know, and I would see her as the nagging mother
yes.
again. And this is goes on in everybody's life.
Yes.
Everybody. I mean,
yes.
I don't think
oh,
that you are unique
dear.
Either.
No, I guess not. Everyone is sort of astonished that she comes for 3 weeks.
3 weeks is a little long.
That's what everyone says.
A week, I think. A week should do it.
Yes.
Well, now, your latest book came out last year. I hope that Farrar, Straus & Giroux still has this in print, keeping this in print. Came out last year, a wonderful book, and I assume that it, to a degree, traces some of your own development when you came, because when you left, you went to work as a babysitter, I guess, right?
I guess so, though I sort of just say I went to work as a servant. Mm-hmm. And I say that because I think it's obvious that girls like me, I don't know, perhaps less so, but certainly in the late 60s when I came here, girls like me, a girl from with my complexion and my background isn't... a babysitter on the way to something else, that when you come from my part of the world, you are going to be a housemaid, if that's how you start out. Or, I mean, perhaps one in a thousand isn't. But basically, my station in life was that I was going to be a servant, and that if I had remained as the housemaid, the nursemaid, for the rest of my life, no one would have been surprised by it. So, yes, in the book, she's described as an au pair. And I think that I did that because it's only in retrospect that I would have, you could call someone like me an au pair or whatever it is, the babysitter. But at the time, in my real life, it didn't seem as if it was just something I was doing for them. just for then, that eventually I would go on and write books or whatever. That seemed as if it would be my life.
Well, it seems to me, in reading Lucy, that Lucy had a rather difficult adjustment. In fact, she seemed to be a rather difficult girl.
Yes, well, yes. I don't see why she should be pleasant. Some people, I think mostly men, actually, as far as I can tell from reviews, most men who reviewed it find her hard to take. I think one reviewer, a man at Newsweek, I think, called her vinegary. But he found it distasteful that she was so vinegary.
Not sure what that means exactly.
Well, not someone you'd like. And I thought, well, I've never really, I tried to think, I've never seen a review in which a male character was not liked because he was unpleasant. And people do say that about her, that she was so hard to like. But I sort of rather like people who are difficult to like, and I'm difficult to like, I think. I always expect people won't like me, because why should they? I like myself very much, but I don't see why anyone should agree with me. So yes, she's sort of hard to like, but I think that's what's good about her, is that she's sort of courageous enough not to be pleasant. It takes...
Well, what she's doing is displaying a high degree of independence.
I think so. I hope so. And I think courage. I mean, it would have been very easy to be in a situation like that and try to be winning. And
at least Lucy didn't become a bureaucrat and work for the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Like,
you know,
her friend.
Try to reach a clerical person at the Department of Motor Vehicles and you reach a Lucy, it's going to be difficult.
It's going to be very difficult. Good heavens. Well, she would have had to give up a lot to do that, including her citizenship, which I don't think someone like that would do. But she's very... she sort of has something in mind, and she doesn't know what, and that's all. It was sort of very wonderful to write about it. I didn't know, you know, that it was going to be a book and that anyone would want to buy it. I just sort of, I wanted to see about something that had happened to me, and so I wrote it. But I sort of rather like her. Sometimes I read it and I think, oh, just the kind of person I would like, because I don't really think of it as myself, but I think this is just the sort of person I would like, or I would like to be like, sort of.
Well, she is. She is like you. Well, becoming a writer was a relatively slow evolutionary process for you, wasn't it? You started doing some work at The New Yorker. How did this all come about?
Oh, well, I actually had been working at a place called, a magazine called The New Ingenue for, and it was owned by the people who owned the National Lampoon. And there was a man named Michael O'Donoghue, and this is, I hope it's not too roundabout a story, but it was a man named Michael O'Donoghue who met me and introduced me to his friend George Tro, who was a reporter at The New Yorker, is a reporter at The New Yorker still. And George befriended me and was very kind to me and was very, showed me a great deal of kindness and affection and interest. He just thought I was an interesting person. I don't know why now. But he just would take me around to parties with him and would write about me. And I was at the time trying to be a writer, but I didn't know how. I knew what a good piece of writing was, but I didn't know how to do it. So one day he just said, you know, I said something to him, and I remember the moment because we were sitting in a Lebanese restaurant on 28th Street and Lexington Avenue. It was 1974, I think. And I was saying something to him, and he said, oh, would you like to meet Mr. Sean? He laughed and then said that. And I didn't know who Mr. Sean was, and I just said, sure. So he took me to meet Mr. Sean. I had lunch with Mr. Sean at the Algonquin, and Mr. Sean said I should try and write something. And one day I did, but only I didn't think I was writing. I thought I was typing up my notes. And I would give them to George, who would then rewrite them in a proper talk of the town story. And the next thing I knew, they appeared in the magazine just as I had written down my notes. And with my notes and my reflection on my memory of the event, I just sort of wrote out these sentences of what happened, what event after event. It was a week-long thing I had attended, and I just wrote it out. It appeared in the magazine. I read it, and I thought, this is my writing.
It was kind of startling.
It was very startling.
Wrote in print.
It was very startling because suddenly I realized that just the way I think was my writing. I'd been trying to write, you know, like writing. And then suddenly I saw my writing, and it was just me. So that's how I started to write. One minute I couldn't write, and the next minute I had something appear in the New Yorker.
But the New Yorker began publishing your stories. These are little stories that most of them at the bottom of the river were in the New Yorker.
Yes, they
and
were.
They're strange little stories.
Now, that was yet another discovery I made. After that happened, that first understanding of what my writing was, I wrote for Talk of the Town for a number of years, and every year, the beginning of every year, you know how you make a wish at New Year's?
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of every New Year, I would say, oh, I wish this would be the year I write fiction. And one year, 1978, I made the same wish again. And sometime in February, I'd be trying to write fiction and trying to write fiction, and it just wouldn't work. Every time I wrote something, it seemed sort of a memoir of some kind, and it wasn't quite what I wanted to do. And one day in 1978, February, I sat down and I wrote that story called Girl. And actually, I've sort of neglected to mention this to people who have asked me, and I really would like to mention it. The big influence, I think, on that story, certainly the courage to sort of write it that way, came, I had just read the first poem in a book called Geography 3 by Elizabeth Bishop. And I had just read the first poem. And I think it's called In the Waiting Room. It's a very beautiful poem. The whole book is very beautiful. And I read it, and I sat down and I wrote Girl. And I don't think it bears any resemblance. But I knew when I wrote that it wasn't like a story that you usually see, but I didn't care. I didn't care if it didn't work for anyone else. I didn't care if the New Yorker didn't like it, if everyone who read it thought it was really bad and stupid and pretentious. I didn't care. That was what I wanted to do. And I wrote it in one sitting, really. And I showed it to my husband, and he really liked it. But I thought, well, he's in love with me. Why wouldn't he like this? And then I gave it to Mr. Sean, and he was very, he liked it a lot, and they bought it. The New Yorker bought it. And that was another moment where I knew how it is, what it was my writing was. When I wrote that story, I knew that I wanted to do things in a certain way, and I couldn't really care whether other people found it interesting, that I would just continue in this certain way. And I wrote all those stories and exhausted that form of writing for me, and then started to write the stories in Annie John, which again I thought no one would like, because why would anyone in North America want to know about a young girl in the West Indies, in the fringe of the world? And by the time I started to write Annie John, I knew in some way that there would be quite a few forms my writing would take. It's always very difficult to write, but I sort of feel many things that I can do. I may never get to do them. May never have the time or really even the intellectual... I have all sorts of ideas about things, and I may not really be as bright as I think. I may not be It's always very difficult to write, but I sort of feel many things that I can do. I may never get to do them, may never have the time or really even the intellectual. I have all sorts of ideas about things, and I may not really be as bright as I think. I may not be able to sort of do what I want to do because it's just sort of very difficult. I'm not afraid to say that or even afraid to know that. So I might not write as this might be all I write, these four books. But I know when I'm doing it that, so, you know, that it's possible to do. I mean, I sort of understand how it is I can write.
Writing is very hard. It's very difficult, and I'm amused by people who say, "Oh, I have a novel I'd like to write someday," and they never do, because when the time comes for them to sit down to
yes.
do it, it is extremely difficult. And I know this after some 15 years of interviewing writers such as yourself. They almost all tell me the same thing. Some yeah. writers say, "I love it." But most are candid. They say, "I don't like the actual process of writing."
Oh, I know.
It is so difficult.
It's
but
so
there's
difficult.
Something inside
yes.
that makes you do it.
You can't stop. And there actually is that moment where you get a handle on it, and it's incredibly exhilarating. And
yes.
there you don't really think of an audience, or will you sell it, because so much depends on that. I mean, just the rent or your mortgage or some stupid daily thing depends on that. It's just a moment where it doesn't matter, you know, where you're just sort of clicked into some sort of spiritual high or something. You just sort of, it's just sort of working, and there's some sort of beautiful revelation in a sentence just for a moment, you know, and you sort of look at that, and it's really wonderful. But I find that each day when I'm writing, each day just to get to the typewriter is really feels insurmountable, just the effort to sort of get to the typewriter. And so sometimes I've just been able to get to the typewriter, but I haven't been able to get to the actual work because there's just so many things, you know, it's so difficult. Also, you're, well, it's in the case of someone like myself, you're just churning up things that, you know, very difficult, very, I mean, I sort of, in some ways, I'm my own psychiatrist. I just am sort of burrowing all the time and, you know, trying to find meaning in the world, really, through the small events in my own life, which I think is sort of crazy to do, but I don't know really how else to live, so.
Jamaica Kincaid, we're out of time. Would you mind reading a portion of Girl?
Oh, not at all.
Because Girl's one of the one sentence. One
yes,
long
it's
sentence.
Very, yes.
It's relatively short, but maybe just a portion of it, even it's short. Well, just read it, because it's only
yes.
really about two
all
pages.
All right, you'll just cut it out if you like.
Yeah.
All right. Wash the white clothes on Monday and put them on the stone heap. Wash the color clothes on Tuesday and put them on the clothesline to dry. Don't walk barehead in the hot sun. Cook pumpkin fritters in very hot, sweet oil. Soak your little clothes right after you take them off. When buying cotton to make yourself a nice blouse, be sure that it doesn't have gum on it, because that way it won't hold up well after a wash. Soak salt fish overnight before you cook it. Is it true that you sing Benna in Sunday school? Always eat your food in such a way that it won't turn someone else's stomach. On Sundays, try to walk like a lady and not like the slut you are so bent on becoming. Don't sing Benna in Sunday school. You mustn't speak to wharf rat boys, not even to give directions. Don't eat fruits on the street. Flies will follow you. But I don't sing Benna on Sundays at all, and never in Sunday school. This is how to sew on a button. This is how to make a buttonhole for the button you have just sewed on. This is how to hem a dress when you see the hem coming down, and so to prevent yourself from looking like the slut I know you are so bent on becoming. This is how you iron your father's khaki shirt so that it doesn't have a crease. This is how you iron your father's khaki pants so that they don't have a crease. This is how you grow okra far from the house, because okra tree harbors red ants. When you are growing dasheen, make sure it gets plenty of water, or else it makes your throat itch when you are eating it. This is how you sweep a corner. This is how you sweep a whole house. This is how you sweep a yard. This is how you smile to someone you don't like too much. This is how you smile to someone you don't like at all. This is how you smile to someone you like completely. This is how you set a table for tea. This is how you set a table for dinner. This is how you set a table for dinner with an important guest. This is how you set a table for lunch. This is how you set a table for breakfast. This is how to behave in the presence of men who don't know you very well, and this way they won't recognize immediately the slut I have warned you against becoming. Be sure to wash every day, even if it is with your own spit. Don't squat down to play marbles. You're not a boy, you know. Don't pick people's flowers. You might catch something. Don't throw stones at blackbirds, because it might not be a blackbird at all. This is how to make a bread pudding. This is how to make dukkana. This is how to make pepper pot. This is how to make a good medicine for a cold. This is how to make a good medicine to throw away a child before it even becomes a child. This is how to catch a fish. This is how to throw back a fish you don't like, and that way something bad won't fall on you. This is how to bully a man. This is how a man bullies you. This is how to love a man. And if this doesn't work, there are other ways, and if they don't work, don't feel too bad about giving up. This is how to spit up in the air if you feel like it, and this is how to move quick so that it doesn't fall on you. This is how to make ends meet. Always squeeze bread to make sure it's fresh. But what if the baker won't let me feel the bread? You mean to say that after all you're really going to be the kind of woman who the baker won't let near the bread?
I hear Mama talking.
Yes. Yes.
It was a pleasure to meet you, Kincaid. Thank you very much.
Thank you.